Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is a 100-mile diet as good for the environment, human health, and regional economies as we've been led to believe? Supporters of the local food movement have made great strides in the past decade in convincing consumers that buying food sourced from nearby producers is nearly always better for their bodies, their farm-employed neighbors, and the planet as a whole than food shipped in fresh from every corner of the world. But my guest today says global food production and distribution systems have indisputable benefits for consumers as well as producers, and that the environmental impact of so-called food miles has often been grossly overstated. Pierre Desrochers is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto and served as a research fellow at the Center for the History of Political Economy at Duke University. His new book, co-authored by Hiroko Shimizu, is called The Locavore's Dilemma, in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. Pierre, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
What made you begin to question what has become conventional wisdom as to the value of eating local?
Well, my co-author, who also happens to be my wife, long story short, a few years ago we attended a talk in which a prominent environmental scientist took the local food logic to its logical conclusion and declared matter-of-factly during his talk that obviously, the Japanese people are the most parasitical on the planet because they import more food from other food sheds than anybody else. And so you mentioned that the name of my wife is Hiroko Shimizu. Well, she happened to have grown in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And so she was like, well, we're not parasites. I mean, we don't have room to grow food. So what do? Well, we use our brains. We create technologies, consumer goods. We raise living standards the world over. And we pay for our food. Now, what's wrong with that? Everybody is better off in the process. You know, people in New Zealand or the United States that have a lot more agricultural land can specialize in that and provide a better diet to the Japanese, who in return do other things and contribute to improving the living standards the world over in other ways.
It is interesting that we do not get nearly as upset about importing other kinds of products that we use on a regular basis as we do about food from other parts of the world.
Yeah, no, food is remarkably emotional. I mean, obviously this is something that we all need to survive. But I mean, I'm Canadian, and as you can tell from the accent, I'm French-Canadian. Well, heat in the winter is pretty much essential to our survival. But yeah, no, there's no argument in Quebec about importing petroleum, heavy oil, or natural gas from other locations. But food somehow is always something that really gets people to their stomach, if you might excuse the pun.
There's also the reality that in Toronto, you can't grow a lot of different kinds of food that you might want to eat. And you point out the fact that the Buy Local campaign started in California, where in fact you can
exactly
eat local and eat a lot of different things for, you know, 10, 11 months of the year.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, the movement really started in Berkeley. And, well, I assume you know the expression Bobo's bourgeois bohemian.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was our sense of the real origin of that food fad. People who can afford to pay more, people who don't have a problem really paying $8 for a local peaches, that granted will be very good. But it's just not something that can be applied in most other locations. And somehow, to our surprise and our dismay, a movement that started in Berkeley, where the conditions are very unique, spread like wildfire across the United States and Canada. And what we try to do in the book is to remind people that, well, you know, if things were so great when most food was sourced locally, why did people bother developing the international food supply chain in the first place?
Let's talk about the evolution of the global food system we have today, because it really corresponded with changes in how people lived, in where people lived. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, and also about how people moved and preserved food. I mean, up until perhaps the late 18th century, except for things like sugar or cereal grains that could be moved over a long distance very slowly, let's say by sailboat, most food was produced locally. And as a result, people were really, in many cases, having poor quality nutrition. I mean, rampant malnutrition was common in Europe until maybe the middle of the 19th century, when the railroad and the steamship came along and allowed people to tap into the food resources of other parts of the world. And the main benefit to begin with was to actually put an end to famine and malnutrition, because we tend to forget today, but most regions of the world, whatever your agricultural system production might be, will suffer from bad harvests. I mean, I was listening before I came on the air. You guys seem to have been hit pretty badly by rainstorms and flash floods in the south. Well, in the past, you know, get 2 years like that, two bad harvests in a row, and people would starve. Mm-hmm. And what happened with long-distance transportation, especially the railroad in landlocked regions, is that the surpluses of regions where the crops had been abundant could be channeled to other regions where the crops had been bad, and vice versa. So what long-distance trade in food did at first was to essentially spread the risk across a much larger geographical area. And that was the first immediate benefit of the long-distance traded food. But there were others, of course.
We don't talk too much about this, but we have actually made really significant strides just over the past couple of decades in fixing the problem of global hunger. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, of course. Well, we still have about a billion people, give or take, that are malnourished on the planet. But what people tend to forget is that these are the people who are living the locavores or the local food dream. They're a subsistence farmer in sub-Saharan Africa and portions of South Asia. And they suffer from the same types of problems that Europeans suffered all the way up to the middle of the 19th century. The road system there is atrocious. They need to produce most of their food themselves, or at least buy or sell from their neighbors. And again, when they have bad years, these people are in terrible condition. But fortunately, most of humanity is now linked and interdependent on other parts of the globe on a major scale, to an extent that was never the case, obviously, before. And what we argue in the book is that we need more of that. I mean, the real problem of sub-Saharan Africa is not enough local food. It's too much local food. We need to spread the risk.
You said a number of myths here about locavorism, starting with the idea that it nurtures social capital. In theory, how do advocates say people benefit when consumers have more direct relationships with those who produce their food?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, today we don't know who produces our shirts. We don't know who produces our laptops or iPods. But somehow food is thought to be different. And it is believed that getting to know the people who produce the food that you eventually end up eating will somehow create more social capital. And so a number of people in Western Europe, North America, and elsewhere have set up schemes which are often called community-supported agriculture, in which people engage in some sort of long-term, or at least a summer-long or growing season-long contract with local farmers, in which they pay ahead and they accept whatever the local farmers send them. But the problem with those schemes is that consumers have to share the risk. And what advocates of these schemes essentially tell you that you have to do is that, well, if there's a pest infestation, if there's a drought, if there are some other problems, don't complain. You share the risk with the farmer. Well, the problem is that typically what happens if your kids go to summer camp for 3 weeks and you had not planned that and you had ordered food for five people, but you end up only needing to feed two people? Well, you waste or you compost a lot of stuff. What if you have guests that you had not planned? Well, you need to do extra trips to the shopping mall or some retail store somewhere. And in general, what these schemes have turned out to be is really a drain on consumers' pockets and time, because you need to go meet the farmer wherever it is convenient for the producer to meet you. So by trying to bypass wholesalers and retailers, a lot of people are reminded that these people actually play a useful function, because you get the amount of food that you need where you need it at a price that is more affordable, you save time, and that gives you more time to, I don't know, coach minor league soccer, be more active in your church, or do other things that will actually contribute to growing local social capital.
And farmers markets promise some of those relationships that people crave, but you point out that they're not always what they appear to be.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, we local food activists really don't like brands and don't like to buy from, you know, one big company which tells you what the food is, which country, let's say, it was produced, and guarantees uniformity across what you buy. But then you have to ask yourself, well, what were people saying before brands were developed? And it turns out that historically, there was a lot of shady dealings going on at local markets. And you still have the same problem today because if you Google, for example, farmers markets and fraud, well, you read journalistic reports of, you know, journalists going to a local farmers market somewhere, asking the farmer, well, who are you? Where's your farm? What do you produce? And then going check out the farm and realizing that nothing grows there. And that the only thing that was truly local at the food that they bought at the farmers market was that it was bought at the local Costco. And so there's really no incentive to sue or to enforce strong standards with fly-by-night operations. I mean, these people sign a form when they typically get a stall at a farmer's market, and yes, I swear that my food is from this or there. But obviously, this set the context for a lot more fraud than would otherwise be the case. I mean, large retailers are open to lawsuits, and they're much more careful that way.
Well, we do know farmers markets locally are required to say whether they are a food distributor as opposed to the actual grower. So there are some verifications, but I can understand your point there. Talk about this. Michael Pollan and other local food champions have said we would all be just physically healthier if we would choose to eat more food, but be willing, less food rather, but be willing to pay more for it. You remind us that's not an easy decision for families living even at the middle class and certainly below it.
Well, exactly. It seems to me I was getting to Bobo's before. You know, for people who can cut down on the $8 cappuccino or something, well, fine. You know, if you want to pay more and eat less, I don't have a problem with that. But most people, especially in this economy, are probably trying to stretch their food dollars as much as possible. And again, nobody would bother going through the trouble of importing food from some distance if it did not deliver significant benefits, especially in terms of price. So yes, you can grow more food, let's say, in Canada where I'm from, but we wouldn't need to heat greenhouses year-round. I mean, it gets pretty cold up here in the winter. And we're better off, it turns out, importing food, let's say, from Florida or California, or Texas for that matter, where you guys have better growing conditions at certain time of the year. So even in that context, trucking food from warmer locations to Canada, as opposed to eating our greenhouses using a lot of natural gases doing so, actually ends up being both cheaper and better for the environment.
Yeah, speak about the importance, since you are a professor of geography, of physical topography in terms of growing certain things that we want. It makes more sense. You can more efficiently grow things based on if you go according
to
climate. Exactly.
It's something that people tend to forget today. I mean, I teach suburban kids who generally believe that the food grows on the trucks that deliver it to, you know, the local supermarket. But it turns out that, you know, some regions have more water than others. Some regions have more sunshine than others, even if they're at the same latitude. Some regions might have less humidity. So, for example, if you add orchards in regions that are drier, typically you have less of a fungus problem, so you need less pesticides to grow, let's say, peaches or apples or something like that. So there are a whole set, and of course the type of soil will vary from in some regions. So some type of soil might be well suited for cotton, but let's say not for corn or soybeans or some other crops. So people tend to forget that physical geography does matter. And again, there's a reason why the advent of long-distance trade encouraged regional specialization. I mean, it's been a while since I've been to Texas, but as far as I know, you guys are still producing a lot of livestock down there. Well, mm-hmm. I guess you have better and other regions like Iowa are better at producing corn. I mean, I'm sure that they could produce livestock in Iowa, but it is simply more valuable to produce corn or soybeans. So these things tend to work themselves out and in the end, again, deliver more food for lower prices.
My guest is Pierre Desrochers. He is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto and co-author, along with Hiroko Shimizu, of the new book, The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. You can be part of the conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pierre de Rocher. He is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto and co-author of the new book, The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. You can be part of this conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Pierre, what about this idea that buying food from local producers is an investment in our own community and therefore keeps money nearby?
Yeah. Well, you have first to distinguish whether you buy the local food either because it is more affordable or better quality, or at least you get your money's worth, or you buy local food because it is local and it has no other attributes than being local. So it is more expensive, lesser quality, and all of that. Now, we obviously have no problems against people buying local food when it makes sense from a quality price perspective. But when you buy more expensive local food, well, typically what happens is that you will create a few jobs in the farm sector, in the agricultural sector, but consumers will have less money to spend on other things. And in the process, you will end up destroying more jobs than you create. And think also of the exporters, the people in other regions who used to send you food more cheaply. You stop buying from them, well, then they have less money to buy other things from your economy that you might be better at. So essentially, what locavores are telling us is to, again, pay more for less, which makes people poorer, and poorer people don't grow an economy.
Now, you mentioned this idea of, you know, it doesn't make sense to buy local food if it is of lesser quality. Now, for a lot of people who believe in buying local, they say that the quality doesn't even compare, that the stuff you buy from 10 miles away is automatically better and better for you than what might be trucked in from or shipped in from Chile or somewhere.
Well, I might disagree with that, but even granting that, then what are you going to do? Let's say that you produce something local that is very good for, let's say, 6 weeks out of 52 each year. Then what do you do for the rest of the year? I mean, you freeze the thing, you can the thing, you refrigerate it, whereas if you buy from other parts of the world, you get fresh food that, okay, will not be as good as local food, but if the key really is freshness, then you cannot deny that year-round, an entirely local-based diet will be less fresh. And so how can it be better? So yes, buy in season, again, if it tastes better and it is worth the price. But then if you buy local because it is fresher and it tastes better, you cannot argue against sourcing out fresh supplies from other locations for the rest of the year. It just doesn't make sense. You cannot have it both ways.
Do we have an obligation to make sure that we buy food from producers who pay ethical wages to the people who are doing the labor on farms?
Well, define ethical. I mean, honestly, in our advanced economies, most people don't want to work on farms anymore. Now, I understand you've got perhaps different conditions in Texas, but where I grew up in Canada, trust me, we import labor from other countries to work our fields. And ultimately, it's sad to say, but you don't grow an economy by going back to, let's say, growing garlics or producing apples when people in other countries are willing to do that either more efficiently or more cheaply than you are. We import, for example, in Canada, for example, a problem we've had these last few years is that the Chinese have really been killing us in the apple market. But producing apples in Canada, the labor cost is about 75% of the local cost. And local people don't want to pick up apples anymore. And you might say that, well, okay, the Chinese laborer that pick up those apples do not earn the Canadian minimum wage. But at the same time, it is the best real-world opportunity they have in their own local economy. So by all means, let them do that. And eventually, just like Canadians and Americans did in the past, they will move on to more value-added activities, and perhaps apple production will be sorted out in other countries where people do earn a better living picking apples than doing other things.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones now to Steve in Addison. Hi, Steve. Hello, Steve.
Hi, how are you? Yes, I basically agree with what the author is saying, or appreciate his points. However, I think he's so far hasn't addressed the crucial point of the foundation of the global food network is fossil fuels. And I'm not just talking about fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides, but also mainly the transportation network depends on oil.
Well, I appreciate the question, Steve, and this is definitely covered in the book. So, Pierre, why don't you talk about what you discovered in that regard?
Okay, well, two elements. The first is that people tend to forget that the global food supply chain was not created with petroleum, but with coal. Regions began to specialize again when the railroad and steamships came along. And nobody denies that we have several centuries' worth of coal in terms of reserves. Of course, today we would use coal a lot more efficiently than in the past. You know, we would liquefy it, but that would not be a problem. We're not going to revert back to, let's say, medieval Europe, where there were no fossil fuels whatsoever, even if the peak oil scenario was true. We will still have regional specializations and food moving the world over. It will just be more expensive and less convenient. But overall, transportation is so insignificant compared to production that geographical differences between regions will still ensure that we will have long distance food trade. And at any rate, you know, the peak oil scenario has been around for a very long time. I mean, in the United States, people were complaining about running out of oil even before Colonel Drake drilled the first oil well in western Pennsylvania in 1859. What would happen in those days, you know, people would drill for water and then they would find petroleum and they would say, what a disaster, but then it was marketed as a cure. But then what has happened over time is that human ingenuity has found ways to discover new deposits. I mean, you're in Texas. I'm sure I don't need to tell much about to your listeners about the revolution in shale oil production, shale gas. You look at all the new stuff that we're able to turn into a resource these last few years, and the peak oil scenario simply does not hold. But even if it was true, and let's say, what was that movie, Independence Day, you know, evil aliens come in and steal all our base oil deposit, we would simply revert back to coal, and we would still have a long-distance food trade. There's no argument against it.
How does the fuel used to transport food in this global system compare with the fuel that's required to grow food and to store food at home and to cook it?
It is completely insignificant. I mean, these are numbers that are essentially back of the envelope calculation. But in the United States, the numbers that some authors have come up with is that if you look at the carbon dioxide equivalent, or let's say the environmental impact of food production, 4% can be traced back to long-distance transportation, and 83% to production. So irrigation, heating greenhouses, keeping things in refrigerated cold storage, manufacturing all sorts of inputs. So long-distance transportation is really insignificant. And think of it this way. A container ship is perhaps the most marvelous thing that humans have invented to save energy. It floats on water. It has extremely efficient diesel engines. It burns the worst liquid fraction of petroleum that would not have really much of a market apart from that. I mean, bunker fuels. And the railroads are also extremely efficient, much more than trucks. So long-distance transportation, as opposed to even people taking their cars, going to the supermarket, doing their groceries and coming back home, is almost entirely inconsequential. And what people tend to forget is that if you cut the distance that things have traveled, then again, you need to heat your greenhouses, you need to refrigerate things. The savings that you realize on the transportation sides are more than compensated and several times over made worse by the additional energy that you need to produce food closer to where you live as opposed to in better conditions elsewhere.
Well, let me push back there because, I mean, if it takes energy to produce food, it takes energy to produce food here or there or anywhere. That part of the equation isn't any different, is it?
Yeah, no, but let's look, for example, at the case of Europe. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with that, but growing tomatoes in Europe today are mostly grown in Spain along the Mediterranean coastline. So the problem historically there is that the climate is very dry, but what people have been doing over those last few decades is to build greenhouses that are not heated, but that have the advantages of keeping the humidity around the tomato plants. And so you get tremendous tomato yields there, and it has less of an impact overall than putting those tomatoes from Spain, from the Mediterranean coast, on a truck and delivering them to England, where the weather is cold and gray and which is really not as good to grow tomatoes as the Mediterranean coast. And so in order to power the heat, to provide heat to those greenhouses, you end up actually burning a lot more fossil fuel, in that case mostly natural gas, than letting nature do their work on the Mediterranean coast and putting these things on a truck and delivering them to England.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ben in Fort Worth. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Well, this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I shop at a local farmer's market pretty regularly here in Fort Worth. And to me, I should, based on my income, I should be shopping at a discount grocery store. But I'm really shopping for flavor. And I bought the most delicious, beautiful tomatoes on Saturday that I really don't think I could find at a grocery store, except maybe for a high-end grocer that's buying them probably from the same farmer.
Hmm. You want to come?
Yes, and I don't have a problem with that. The problem is when local food activists want to impose that choice on other people. I mean, you might decide that, you know, you spend your income the way you want to spend it, but people might have other priorities. And if somehow you deny people the choice of buying, let's say, less flavorful but much cheaper tomatoes, I'm not willing to go with that. It might make more sense to import less delicious tomatoes from Florida. Maybe a majority of people are happy with that because this is what we've seen historically. So if people want to do it with their own money, that's fine. But the problem that I have is that increasingly local food activists are trying to mandate military bases, prisons, school boards, universities, various government agencies. They're trying to mandate the purchase of pricier local food. And this is where, honestly, we part way with the locavore movements. If it is completely voluntary and if you think you get your money's worth, fine. But don't force local food down the throat of people who don't want to pay for it.
Pierre, talk a little bit about the issue of land use and wildlands as opposed to lands that are cultivated and,
yes,
and all of that that comes up in the book.
Sure. Well, what people don't realize is that in the last few decades, and going back in some cases over a century and a half, the forest cover or wildland in every economy that is at the level of development of Chile or higher has actually increased. And so what has happened is that by making it possible to grow food in the best conditions pretty much around the world, a lot of marginal land, marginal agricultural land has been abandoned the world over, and nature is much better off as a result. So, for example, in the United States, in the book, we discussed the case of the Shenandoah Valley, where until wheat could be imported from places like, let's say, Montana or the Dakotas, wheat had to be produced locally in very bad conditions. I mean, people would grow wheat on hillsides, which was a disaster in terms of eroding the landscape and doing a lot of damage. But eventually, wheat production from further west comes online, and a lot of land is either converted into pasture land or, let's say, orchards in the Shenandoah Valley, which is much friendlier to the land, considering the local topography, or is abandoned altogether, and the forest grows back. And this has been happening the world over. So again, by moving things around and producing things where they make the most sense, we produce a lot more food, a lot more affordably, using a lot less land. And this, we argue, is much better than, again, if people in the Shenandoah Valley were to start producing wheat again today. They would have the same problems that people had a century and a half ago.
Any reason to doubt, Pierre, that when the population, if, as predicted, it tops out at about 9 billion in the middle half of this century, any reason to believe we will have trouble feeding that many mouths in terms of our ability to produce that food if all goes as planned?
Well, I can promise you that you will have a lot more trouble if you revert back to local production than if you decide to specialize food in the best locations the world over and feeding the world with the most efficient, high-yield farming in the best location wherever you can find them. So we're not guaranteeing the result, but you're sure going to have a lot more trouble if you revert to local food systems than expanding the global division of agricultural labor we have at the moment.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have John on the line in Dallas. Hey, John.
Hey, John. Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Terry. Appreciate it. Real quick question for you, just sort of general. Has national security ever played a role in food sourcing, as well as, you know, for instance, distribution and economy, as well as potential terrorism? Has that ever been a subject of conversation?
Yes, if I may. So in the book, we actually go back to ancient Athens over two millennia ago. I mean, the word autarky, which you might have been familiar from, actually comes from the Greek autarkeia, which is this notion that the Athenians wanted to be free from trade, and so they wanted to produce as much of their own resources as they could. But the problem is that historically, whether it be Athenians 2,000 years ago or Adolf Hitler in the 1940s, the way you do that is by conquering other people. And again, one of the starting points of the book is, again, my wife happens to be Japanese. And if you know a little bit about the history of Japan in the 20th century, this is a very interesting lesson. In the early, so Japan opens up to world trade in the late 19th century. Their standard of living really takes off. They began producing manufacturing goods, exporting more foods. But then foreigners are unhappy with that, and they stop buying cheap Japanese goods. And the result is that in Japan, increasingly the military and fascistic people take over, and they say, well, we cannot rely on others to feed ourselves because they won't buy our manufactured products. So what do we do? Well, you know, let's go invade Taiwan, let's go invade Korea, let's go invade Manchuria and produce our own food. And historically, you know, you have this saying, if goods don't cross borders, armies eventually will. And what we argue in the book is that the notion of local food as increasing food security is typically looked at the wrong way. Essentially, what local food activists want you to do is to put all your agricultural eggs in one regional basket. But again, as I mentioned before, historically, this was a recipe for famine because you will have bad years from time to time. What we argue is that what has really brought peace and increased food security the world over is, as you would do with any forms of risk management, multiplying your sources of supply. So, of course, if you're a country and you somehow feel threatened by another and you're entirely dependent on that country, well, that's going to be a problem. But if you need to buy wheat today, you can buy wheat from Canadians, Americans, Australians, in good years, Indians, Argentinians, all sorts of other people. So you spread the risk that way. Nobody can blackmail you. And what we argue in the book is that the more diversified the world production is, the more suppliers you have, the more food secure you ultimately are.
Pierre Desrochers is my guest. He's Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto and co-author, along with Hiroko Shimizu, of the new book, The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pierre Desrochers. He's Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto and co-author of The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We've talked about food security, but I wonder if you can speak for a moment, Pierre, about food safety, because there is this question of whether getting food from sources all over the globe makes it hard to trace the source of an outbreak of food contamination.
Yeah. Well, of course, there can be no perfectly safe food system anywhere else. I mean, we're surrounded by nasty stuff like salmonella, listeriosis, E. coli, which are all around us, which have been around since humanity has been around. So from time to time, things will go wrong. I mean, you had a big outbreak of listeriosis last year in your country. 25 people died. It was a pesticide-free, four-generation family farm in southeastern Colorado that was at the source of that. Obviously, the farmer didn't want to poison his customers. I mean, nobody wants to do that, whether you're big or you're small. But the thing is that things will go wrong from time to time. So then the real question becomes, well, what do you do about it? And what has happened in the last several decades is that as the best businesses have gotten bigger, they've developed food safety protocols that have become increasingly sophisticated to identify and trace these problems. I mean, a lot of people today feel that our food supply is less safe than it was before. It's not. I mean, a lot less people die of or are sick from food poisoning than in the past. But because of things like barcodes, because of things like the news cycle, which is now, 24 hours a day, we get a lot more reports on that because we can trace the source of the problem. So what happened in the past is that a lot of people would get sick of E. coli, would get sick of listeria, but people wouldn't know what they were sick of, and people would not notice that.
Mm-hmm.
And what we argue in the book is that there are such things as, if I may speak like an economist, as economies of scale in food safety. And so producing the same amount of food with, let's say, 150 small producers who don't have much training in terms of food safety, who cannot really recognize salmonella, who don't have the same safety protocols as one large producer, will actually end up, like it did in the past, killing more people than it is today. And, of course, a lot of people are reluctant to import food from less advanced economies. But, again, what matters is how the food is produced, not where. So if, let's say, an American firm goes and invests in another country because, I don't know, water is more abundant, labor is cheaper, what have you, they will typically import the most advanced production technologies that you have, and there will be rigorous controls along the global food supply chain. By contrast, the local producer, like that poor fellow who was producing cantaloupe in Colorado, will not have the technical know-how to do that. And so paradoxically, local food produced by a small producer might be less safe than a large-scale operation operated by a multinational corporation in a distant country whose overall standard of living is much lower than in the United States.
A lot of people would say, though, there's the issue of, you know, that cantaloupe producer, if his customers had only been within a 20 or a 50-mile region, far fewer people might have been exposed to the pathogen.
Well, but then again, you look at food safety statistics, and a century ago, perhaps 100 times more people were sick and died proportionally than is the case today.
Hmm.
So again, a lot more people will get sick locally with multiple small producers who, again, are doing the best that they could, but simply don't have the knowledge and the safety protocols that a large, efficient, modern operation will have.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Benjamin in Denton. Hey, Benjamin.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in the Denton area, and I have a small farm that I'm growing seasonal organic vegetables on, and there's so many things in this discussion of local food that haven't been brought up, but I'm wanting to see if your guest could address the issue specifically of depleting soil health on farmlands, really globally, especially with the growing popularity of very industrialized approaches to farming. And granted, local food is not the solution to that, but so often small local farms don't use farming practices that are on such a scale that deplete soil health through the application of chemical fertilizers and pesticides and fungicides. So I just wanted to see if he could talk to them about that.
All right, thanks for your call. What do you think, Pierre?
Well, sure, happy to. I mean, in the quote, in the book, we quote Plato, who complained about the exact same thing over 2,000 years ago. You know, people visit the Mediterranean today and they think, oh, isn't that a rocky, desolate landscape? Well, a few thousand years ago, it was lush, covered with forests and very good growing soil. But, people had too many goats and people were employing, quote-unquote, organic, old-fashioned ways of growing food in the Mediterranean, and they completely ruined the landscape all over the place. This notion of erosion, of depleting the land, has been around for at least, like I said, 2,000 years, and we do survey some of the literature on the topic written in the United States in the 1920s and 1930s. This is not new. And as your caller was himself saying, local will do nothing about that because, as I was telling you about the Shenandoah Valley example, growing food locally when the local landscape is simply not suited to that type of crop will result in more damage than, again, let's say, growing corns and soybean in Iowa, even if it is on a gigantic scale. So what matters there is not so much the scale, but is the local environment able to withstand the type of crops that you're growing there? And again, paradoxically, by growing crops in the best possible conditions for that type of crop, you, and trading things over long distances, you will end up creating a lot less damage, even though there will, I mean, humans will always have an impact on the environment, but you will end up creating a lot less damage than if you grow a more diversified array of crops in your local area when your local topography is just not suited for whatever it is that you're growing or grazing.
Can you talk about this? These days, at least in this country, the phrase factory farming has become quite an epithet. Do you know, can you think about the reasons why we find it so abhorrent to imagine that our food is being produced from the land in a way that mirrors industrial production?
Actually, I don't, because perhaps I know a little bit about agricultural history. And the point that I often, well, there are two things here. You know, people are happy to buy, food produced by small farms and pay more for it, fine. But then how many people, if you look at the car industry, how many people buy Ferraris? Because essentially Ferraris is the sort of, obviously it's not local, they sell worldwide, but it's the kind of craft shop that produces high quality product that some people like. The problem is that most people cannot afford Ferraris, and we're happy to buy cars mass-produced by GM or Toyota, and nobody seems to have a problem with that. Nobody advocates reverting back to Ferrari-type conditions to produce cars. And at the same time, people tend to believe that we're sicker than we used to be. But you look at the historical data, we're much taller than we used to be. Yes, we die more of cancer today than in the past, but that's because we don't die of other things. I mean, life expectancy in the United States at the turn of the 20th century was 47 years of age. Get rid of child mortality in there by looking what was the life expectancy of people who were 20 years old in 1900. Well, in the United States, it was 60 years. And today, it is 80 years. So obviously, yes, people might be fatter than they are today, but honestly, if you have to compare that with the alternative of malnutrition and starvation, you can hardly make a case for that. And so factory farming, which is nothing more than developing economies of scale and becoming ever more efficient in the way we produce food, has delivered a more diverse, affordable, and more importantly, year-round supply of stuff that are good, that stuff that might not be perfect, but that will give you your daily dose of vitamins, minerals, calories, and what you need. So, no, people don't like economies of scales in food, but they don't seem to have a problem with it in car production. And this is still something of a mystery to me.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Ali in Wichita Falls. Hi, Ali.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
And thank you for attending my call. My question is, when I came here, I had faced two words, organic and non-organic. And people, organic is always more expensive than non-organic. The question is it non-organic as healthy as organic? And if not healthy, why consider it as a food product? I mean, it's sometimes a case of many diseases, like cancer case, because it's mixed with the chemo or something, which people, they advise organic things.
Okay, well, the answer is clear on that. Organic has no nutritional benefits whatsoever. I mean, there was a survey that was recently published of all the good studies on that. And ultimately, if I may get a bit scientific on you here, a molecule is a molecule is a molecule. It doesn't matter to the plant if a nitrogen molecule was captured from the atmosphere through industrial processes or delivered through cow manure. Or if nothing else, synthetic fertilizers, which are manufactured by humans, are often more specifically targeted at a specific crop in a specific location. And what local food advocates downplay or do not want to raise as an issue is the notion that you can almost never have both local and organic. Among other things, the pesticides that organic producers use are often made from tropical plants. And I'm sorry, but you cannot grow those tropical plants close to where you produce your organic food. And also organic food requires a lot of manure. Well, typically the manure used in organic operations come from very conventional dairy operations. Or else, if you want to use guano, which is essentially desiccated bird dung from Peru, well, you've got to ship it all the way from the southern hemisphere. So the book is not about organic, although obviously we raise all those issues, and we see at some point either you believe in the scientific method or you don't. And at any rate, it is almost impossible in most locations to have both local and organic. There's just not enough manure in most places. And there's certainly not enough manure the world around to produce all our food in an organic manner.
Is it your belief, Pierre, that countries like the United States and like Canada and places in Europe where land is relatively speaking expensive will begin to produce less and less food than they do now, and instead the developing world will take up the mantle of that?
Well, it's not just the land. I mean, most people don't want to work in agriculture anymore. Of course, you have a few young, idealistic people who want to move to the countryside, but typically the strong movement has always been from the countryside to the city. So, I mean, the U.S. has very good growing condition. You can replace labor by tractors, so the U.S. will always produce more. But increasingly, as has been the case for decades, less and less people will end up working in agriculture. And what will happen is that people will specialize in the most lucrative crops for whatever they happen to, wherever they happen to be living. So there will still be plenty of food produced in advanced economy. It will be produced by less people. But the type of crops that require a lot of human labor to this day, things like apples, I think will increasingly leave advanced economies and move to countries like China, where people are still willing to pick apples for a living.
I think we have time to take quickly one more question. It's from Robert in Fort Worth. Hi, Robert.
Well, hi. Couple quick questions.
Just give me one because we're running out of time, Robert.
Okay. One was on the forest cover, and I was just wondering if you could make a comment about the sugar cane and the soybean farming that's going down there, and that forest might be a little more important than the Shenandoah Valley. The other thing, and this is related, I'm not sure if he covers this, genetically modified crop.
All right. Let's at least get to the question about the diminishment, I guess, of forest cover in places like Brazil, where
Well, what happens there? It's not big business that is chopping down the trees. It's poor people who are still practicing subsistence farming. But as people transition to more efficient farming with more inputs in those locations, they will produce more food on less land. And I believe that you will see the same type of forest transitions in Brazil that you once saw in the Shenandoah Valley.
Can you talk about how other economists, is this the sort of thing you enjoy arguing with them about, and what does it take to convince them that your way of thinking is correct?
Oh, I think most economists naturally understand comparative advantage. I mean, they don't know much about, let's say, the political history of, tensions between countries in terms of food. Food safety specialists will agree with me that, your Centers for Disease Control is my source for saying that things like listeriosis and salmonella are a much bigger problem than pesticides, but they might not know much about the economics. So our real contribution in the book, I believe, is to borrow knowledge from a wide array of fields that have never been brought together under, let's say, two book covers dealing with that specific issue. So a lot of specialists agree with me. Most specialists actually agree with me on specific topic. It's just that we provide the global picture and they don't.
Pierre Desrochers is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto and served as a research fellow at the Center for the History of Political Economy at Duke University. His new book, co-authored by Hiroko Shimizu, is called The Logivore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet. Pierre, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about Think at kera.org/think, where you can also download the daily podcast, which is free. If you've got questions, comments, or suggestions, send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.